it is not about the tools. It is not about your project. It's about the people. The better your charter is, the higher is your chances of create a winning case. Continuous improvement can mean a lot of things. And I think the first one is to establish the buy-in into that mindset, being better tomorrow than today.
Welcome back to KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If this is your first time listening in, welcome. We're happy to have you join us. Our mission here is simple, to improve companies and improve careers through continuous improvement. We're here to share inspiring stories and journeys from individuals who have embarked down this path of continuous improvement. And through these interviews with these leaders and innovators and change makers, we explore the sparks that ignite transformative journeys, both within organizations and in personal and career growth. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your improvement efforts to the next level, this podcast is here to help guide, inspire, and empower you. I am Keith Norris. I'm the host. Our guest today is Andreas Matter. Andreas is a U.S.-German dual citizen, blending American drive with German precision. He is an engineer by training with 15 years at Dow and executive roles at Henkel, SIG, and in private equity. As founder of Aperia Corporation, he's led over 50 transformation projects across the U.S. and Europe, driving growth, strategy, and turnarounds with a passion for people at the core of every success. So welcome to the podcast, Andreas.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks for being here. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. So we like to start our podcast interview with a little segment we call The Spark. And what I find, a lot of times folks that have chosen this path of business improvement or continuous improvement or lean or whatever flavor you call it, for a lot of folks, there's maybe a moment in time where you remember like, this is for me. I like doing this. I'm curious for you if there was a kind of a transformative moment in your career where you felt like this was a discipline or this was a thing that sent you down this path.
There are actually two angles to it. So one, of course, in the professional life, stepping into it with Dow Chemical, starting in manufacturing. At that time, Dow rolled out Six Sigma and we all became, I'd say, volunteers, right, to become green belts, black belts, and work on all those projects. Part was the desire from Dow to not just have spot-on projects, but to keep them going, right? So when you made an improvement in your chemical facility, that it kept going year after year and not kind of a one-off. And later on, you know, in my career, when I went for interviews, I had always a very interesting question, which was, how would you describe yourself with one word? And the first time around, I'm like, Jesus me, how can I do that, right? And I came up with the word improver, right? That Forever. Is really, I feel, what engineers are do. We're not inventors. We're not PhDs and scientists, right? We're improvers. And throughout my career, I always looked at what can be done better. Is it a machine can run faster? Is it people who are potentially working below their kind of potential they have? So that's kind of a red line for me going through my entire career.
That's interesting. So you were trained at Dow in the Six Sigma methodology, it sounds like.
Yes, we had early on the DMAIC, and then we extended it into the sustainability end of it. We had leverage in and leverage out DMAIC projects to make sure that what worked in one chemical facility would also potentially be of interest in another. So that was kind of the Dow way, right? You either do it or you leave it. And yeah, we did it.
So you mentioned a couple of things that I think are real interesting to me and probably to many others. One of them is the sustainment part. I think that there's this idea, particularly when people get too oriented around like getting a green belt or getting a black belt, like there's this project orientation, like I'm going to get there, I'm going to do this thing. And of course you want to have these milestones, but you also mentioned the sustainment part. I'm curious if you know, what kind of lessons maybe you've learned about how to go from an improvement to a sustainment? Like, what does that actually look like?
Yeah, part of it came natural. Like at Dow, you're in a role, of course, not just for a month or for years or manufacturing. There was a target, there was an overarching goal. We want to reduce manufacturing costs by, let's say, 15%. And you knew already that with your one project, you wouldn't get to 15%. So you need to build something which lasted longer. You also wanted to have projects where, let's say you save a 2% manufacturing cost, which is big, right? You want to have the same 2% next year. So you don't want whatever you did in your project to go away. So there was a vested interest to hand over projects properly to what's called the project owner, right? So the guys who actually afterwards have to live with your project. And I'd always felt that the role of a project manager is very often underestimated. I always say it's a great leadership test. You try to get people to do something for you without them reporting to you. That is very, very important, right? You need to convince them with facts, with data, with emotion, whatever you have in your toolbox to make them work with you on that project and not work on any other project. And that brings in that sustainability. You need to bring it over to the project owner, who is basically your main stakeholder, that it keeps living. So that's kind of very essential.
Interesting. You talked about the role of a project manager. I'm curious, if you were training somebody on how to have a good transformation project, and there's certain roles, are there certain roles that you think, okay, you need to have this role, you need to have that role, or you were kind of getting at like the role of the project leader there. Are there some other roles that you think are, you know, pretty commonly necessary with those type of projects?
Of course. I mean, you have in the modern colloquial language, you would describe it as a doers. We call them the subject matter experts, which sounds much better. So you have the people who actually work on the project. They gather data, they craft charts, they write standard operating procedures, right? So they all need to be on board. For that, you almost need to create like a vision for your project, which obviously is the first item in a project charter. What is the actual problem? And a lot of people jump right to the solution, right? They go right away. I know the answer. I know what it is. And then they go fixing it. And it might fix it for a little bit, but again, not sustainably, right? So that is a big hurdle for a lot of people when you bring in, and I've implemented Six Sigma now a couple of times as well as Lean. That's a big hurdle for people. And the second one is coming down to, I don't have actually time for all that demake, for all the process steps. And then teaching them that you can actually do a demake project in 15 minutes, if you know what you're doing, right? If the project is small. So yeah, so you got the project people working on a project, you got the project leader I mentioned before, you got the owner. In larger corporations where you're not working in isolation, you got your peers, right? They also work on projects. So there you want to bring in that leveraging aspect, that you not repeat a lengthy process of data gathering if it had been done already, for example. And then you got the upper structure, right? A lot of project managers wrestle with competing priorities from other projects and competing funds, right? So you got to make a strong case to whoever is in charge, which for me, I'd say naturally, it kind of was easier as I stepped in typically from the top. But, yeah, if you're a project manager in a larger organization and you need to have funds, which could be either money or people, you need to be able to build a strong case. And I always come back to the project charter. The better your charter is, the higher is your chances of create a winning case.
Yeah, I, as you know, we have charters as a feature in KPI Fire. So I spent a lot of my life talking about project charters. And you mentioned one of my favorite questions with the project is, what is the actual problem that we're solving? Because, man, there's so many conversations that you see happen in boardrooms and on Zoom conversations. It could be hours of conversation about solutions and ideas and things that we should be doing. And then if you pop in and say, what is the actual problem that we're solving? Man, sometimes people in the room are not even on the same page with what problem they're trying to solve. So no wonder there's problems about how to get there. So I think that's definitely a good insight. Always start with the problem.
The problem statement, I feel, is one of the most difficult sentences to complete in a project charter. And you cannot spend enough time on that, because if you got that wrong or you're not articulated well enough, then yeah, you're barking up the wrong tree.
To drill down on that a little bit, could you share like a structure or a format? Is there like maybe an example that you would use for a good problem statement versus maybe one that's not so good?
Yeah, I like to have two angles to it. One is, how would the world look like if the project is solved? So that comes from a positive end, right? And that is, for a lot of people, that's much easier to describe. Yeah. How is life afterwards? And then you can basically reverse it, and that kind of defines your problem, right? So that's one angle. And then the second one is simply really brainstorming, bring in different people from different functions, because everybody sees it slightly different. And what's a problem for one group might not be a problem for the other group at all. Not saying that that wouldn't be a good project, but it never hurts. And also, then, as I mentioned before, if you're in a larger corporate structure as a project manager, you want to make sure that your boss also sees your problem as really a problem.
Yeah, that's such a good example. Nothing more frustrating than spending a whole bunch of time and energy and working on something to find out that, you know, it didn't have the right support or wasn't important to somebody else. One thing that I find interesting when we talk about business improvement or continuous improvement or Six Sigma or Lean, a lot of times I feel like, let's say somebody who's worked in a single company, they feel like, oh, this is what Six Sigma is, or this is what Lean is because, you know, or this is what the Toyota way is because, you know, because how this is how Toyota does it, this is how everybody should do it. I think that the reality of life is that things are a lot more nuanced, and every methodology, whether it's Lean or Six Sigma, it can be implemented differently, and you can use kind of like everybody's on a little different journey. I'm curious, as somebody who sounds like trained in the Six Sigma, how would you describe your business improvement methodology that you preach and practice and implement now? And maybe how is it like similar to the traditional, and maybe how is it a little different?
You made a good point, right? That every company is different. Every person, you know, by design is different. And I'm not going to say we've seen it all, but as you said in the intro, I've managed now many, many continuous improvement projects. And honestly, they're really all different. So you got to have a good toolbox, and what works for one company doesn't work for another. So DMake is always there at its core. I'm an evangelist of DMake. That I think is the core. But then you spin it further. DMake leads you into project management. Then from there, you actually go into portfolio management. So for those who don't know, is if you got multiple projects competing for resources, you need to manage your portfolio of projects, right? You can have a very, very big project with a very high reward, but it might take forever, or there is a large risk associated to it when you want to bring in a new product to the market that could have multi-million dollars attached to it. But what if it doesn't work? What if the market is not ready? You're too early or too late with your product, right? So you want to have a portfolio. So that gets you into portfolio management, which is kind of what I like at KPI Fire, is a 9-box matrix. It is so simple that you would never forget it, but it's conclusive enough that you can really work with it. And that is probably what I would bring it down to, is have simple tools that the people remember. If you always have to go back to your mini tabs in Six Sigma to kind of page through it on what comes next, or the next best statistical analysis, or the FMEA, if it doesn't jump at you, probably don't use it because you might apply it wrong, right? So that's what I encourage people, is keep it simple. That will also help the non-stakeholders to actually understand what you're doing. And that is probably, in addition to work with the people, bring the people on board, I think that is the most important part. And that was, for me, the biggest learning early on. It is not about the tools. It is not about your project. It's about the people who work with you on your project. If they're not convinced that this is a good project, you can use all the tools in the world. It will not convince them, right? You need to bring them on board.
For anybody that's not familiar with DMAIC, sometimes we use jargon on this podcast. So could you just tell us what the DMAIC stands for?
Yeah, DMAIC is define. So that's a defined step. You define your project, which ultimately starts with a project charter. Then it's measure. So that's basically your data gathering that can be short or long, depending on your project. And you want to make sure that you gather the right data, which sounds easy, but you can get completely on the wrong path. The next step is analyze. So you want to analyze your data. What I like is that it's really segregated steps, because as I said at the very beginning, you very often jump to the conclusion and to a summary, and you figure out you're half complete because you didn't look at the full data. So that's really important. And I like to run projects where the data analysis or the analysis step is actually done by different people than the people who gather the data. And then comes the improve step, so the I, which is the actual solution, if you will. And I encourage people throughout the entire stages of DMake to be part of that. So I typically like to run that as very open sessions, because everybody has ideas. And I always bring it back to the charter to say, here's what we said a week ago, a month ago, 3 months ago, whenever that project started. So let's revisit this under the light of what we've learned, right? So you got all those steps, you bring it back to where you started, and then you look for what I always say is the solution that works. I'm never interested in the best solution. I want the solution that works, because that makes it easier in the next step, which is the control, to hand it over to the process owner, to the ultimate owner of that project. If it's simple enough, it is something that works, it will live on. If you come out with a improvement which requires a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of jumping through hoops, that is very difficult to contend in the day-to-day, right? If it is an enormous effort to, let's say, continuously gather data for a certain solution, that would not be a good project improvement. You want to have it kind of standalone, self-sufficient. That way it will be sustainable.
Excellent. I want to come back to, you said you'd like to separate the people working on the measure and the analyze step sometimes. What kind of benefit does that give you?
It's an unbiased view on data. I found that if you, let's say you gather your own data, that's a pitfall of DMake. Then you tend to analyze them in the way you want to have it. And as we all know from our studies in statistics, there's nothing you can't do with numbers. So that's why I'd like to have an unbiased view on the data, if possible. Sometimes it's not, right? If you're in smaller organizations, you just have two people work on the project, or sometimes just one person. Sometimes the project manager is all of those people on a project. So that's a pitfall. And that's when I come in, if you will, as a portfolio manager, or even, let's say, in a small organization, the CEO. That's what I encourage them to check, kind of, okay, what did the data actually tell us? And have the data been bent to tell the story everybody wants to hear?
Now, you also mentioned something called the 9-box method. I wonder if you could explain what that is for us.
Yeah, that's a matrix. And there are many other methods. There's 3 boxes, 6 boxes, whatever else. I don't know why we all ended up with 9. But this basically divides your number of projects you have by size. You could have large, medium, and small projects. And then you could have on the other axis, you could have low, medium, and high risk, or which is not the same. You could have low, medium, and high effort, right? So you could run an effort to risk. You can run an effort to size of the prize, the dollars, if you will. And that shows you very quickly, in a simple way, you can do it on that proverbial back of the napkin. Where am I with my company? Do I have enough projects which are big so that when they come through, that we really get the dollars to fund further improvements or further research or whatever is needed? But also, do I have some smaller ones which are lower risk, which also in the Six Sigma way, at least in the old conventional way, black belts are full-time and they get rewarded on kind of the savings they achieve or the improvements they make, right? So you want to have also some where they can see some of, call it their remuneration. Not all companies really still do it that way. I'd say probably 80 to 90% of the companies we work with, they deviated from that concept. So they might have a full-time master black belt, of course, but then a lot of the black belts we meet, they're in part-time roles, so they manage other stuff as well.
I mean, some of the stuff that we call improvement or business improvement is, you know, you could look at it through one lens and just say, well, that's just good management. That's just good leadership. Every company's supposed to improve and get better. And having been a CEO of public and private companies, you probably know better than anybody. Like, as the CEO, you're responsible for the success of the company, and you can define business improvement in a way. But I think one thing that a lot of employees inside organizations don't realize is that, in one sense, we're all responsible for our own level of business improvement. If you want to get paid more money, the best way to do that is to increase your value for the same rate, get more value. If you want to get more value, get more output for what you're doing. So this little thing that we call business improvement is so fractal in that it's relevant to an individual person who's just trying to improve their career. It's certainly relevant to a PMO office or a Lean Six Sigma office. Of course, it's relevant to senior leaders who are responsible for functions because they're always having to take on these business improvements. I'm curious if you might have some insights on how this particular methodology, like this is a business improvement methodology, helped your career? And if you've seen other versions of this structured problem solving that have been You know, do you look for that when you hire people in your organizations to have some of those similar backgrounds in structured problem solving?
Not necessarily the background. I mean, I would look for, first and foremost, for curiosity. If I interview people and at the end of it, like, do you have any questions? And they're like, no, I don't. That will not make someone in general, right? It's very general speaking here, but who will be designed to really work on that. You want to have curious people. You also want to establish a culture. I know organizations we worked with who have continuous improvement as a kind of program embedded in their strategy. They have a continuous improvement officer or continuous improvement director or manager. So there it lives different. I always look at it, you have a core group of people that they're really good at doing improvements. They're just born to do this. And then you have others where I see it as a valuable pass-through experience. So you could bring in someone from finance to help you on a project for a year or two in the continuous improvement organization, and then they move on back into the finance organization, have learned a lot about the other functions. So that's a great way to nurture and further careers, because most people, everybody wants to have a salary, but people also want to be intrigued. They want to be motivated. They want to get rewards, which, of course, monetary reward is nice. But, I mean, nothing beats it, really, when as a team you have success on a project.
I think you're exactly right. I do think that it's probably not everybody out there, but I do think that everybody generally would rather work in a company where they're engaged and they're working on stuff that matters and they feel like their work is making a difference. And one thing that I do love about this discipline, whether you call it Six Sigma or Lean or business improvement, is the idea of making an impact, you know, and having a, certain skills, I guess you could say, whether it's manufacturing or marketing or finance, like they're disciplines, there's a lot to learn in there. Certainly, but in this structured problem-solving methodology, it can be applicable across different industries. I think you've had some experiences across some different industries, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Can you give us an example of like the breadth of where this problem-solving skill that you've developed has benefited your career?
I would say almost everywhere, and I wouldn't say it's a skill or it's a habit. Again, it is. I'm by design a very curious person. So we could talk now for 10 hours, I don't know, about the books in your bookshelf or whatever. So that is probably the curiosity which brings it forward. Always look at what's under the rock, what's behind the tree, what's underneath the carpet, which has driven a lot of it. And that's why ultimately I ended up in consulting, because that's kind of what we do. If you look at our company name, Aperia comes from Latin. That means unveil, uncover. So that's what we do. We pull the cloak, so to speak. Not everybody wants to hear it, right? But we tell it as it is. And we have lots of projects where we say no, because we feel we can't win there with kind of the strategy with that organization. So we've done this in the automotive industry, where I hear often Lean is just for automotive, right? Or like Six Sigma takes forever. So there's some of those kind of, what people have in their mind. And then, you know, for us, it's a great pleasure to always prove them wrong. But we looked at electronics, where it is very, very important when you look at, for example, semiconductor industry, where the end customers, the large companies, TSMC in Taiwan or so, they spend an ungodly amount on testing their chips they produce, right? So if you can bring that number down by develop methods and methodologies, statistical or other ways, that's huge savings, right? You look at the chemical industry, where you want to run your manufacturing kind of 24/7 and preferably 370 days in a year. Any downtime there is costing you sometimes millions of dollars. So if you work in that end, we work a lot in the packaging industry where, again, downtime. So I have an example, Philip Morris, the cigarette producer, they were wrestling with downtime in their factories in Russia. And when you've seen how many millions of cigarettes can be produced in 15 minutes downtime and they pile up on the shop floor, that is a motivation on a project to fix it, right? So that is something. I'd always like to bring it back to those examples that the people can align with. That makes it easier. And that, again, brings it back to that problem definition. What problem do we want to solve? And I repeat, but it helps if you look at, okay, how does the world look like when we've solved it? So like at Philip Morris, what if you have zero cigarettes on the shop floor?
That's an interesting one. So this, again, I like what you said about curiosity, because I think that's part of, you know, why we put this podcast together, is to talk to people who are at various stages of their career. And if you're somebody who has that instinctual curiosity of why is it that way? Why does it have to be that way? You know, sometimes I don't mean this about you as a consultant, but I know some people are consultants because sometimes they make bad employees because they don't like doing things the way they've always been done. They want to make changes. Like there's in every organization, there's a right way to approach the change culturally and a wrong way to approach the change culturally. There's lots of different job titles, I'm sure, and lots of different paths, but... Mm-hmm. Maybe talk a little bit to that person who might not realize that there's a discipline or a set of skills or even jobs in this, who's maybe just introduced to this podcast because they're implementing KPI Fire in their company and they are a little bit curious. What advice might you have for somebody like that around how to better their skill set for their career?
Well, I think when you step into a new role, and people who know me have heard me say that, is the misconception and the pressure you create for yourself, right? I always say the biggest pressure you create for yourself. So if you come in and you want to deliver on day one, get over it. You won't. No matter what had been promised to you, what promises you made, get over it. And the other one is I always like to quote, I don't know where it actually comes from, is everybody can do easy. If things were easy, you wouldn't be in that role you were in. So there is a specific purpose why you're in that role. And what helps at the beginning, especially if you're like in continuous improvement leadership roles, spend the first couple of days when your calendar is empty, walk around and listen. Listen to your boss who put you in that role. Listen to your peers. Listen to people on the shop floor and try and understand what do they think that role is. Right, that helps you to kind of calibrate a little bit. And it makes you, I'd say, it makes you human, right? The worst thing can happen is you assume a continuous improvement leadership role or you implement KPI Fire and you act 100% on your own assumptions that you're going to fail. You're going to fail miserably.
You know, that you just said something that reminded me of part of your earlier comments. And you mentioned at Dow how you would make these improvements, and then part of what you needed to do was to see if those would work in other places. And I think of that as like a best practice. Mm-hmm. What lessons did you learn about how to share best practices and how to get best practices adopted? Because, you know, there can be a not invented here syndrome sometimes when that's happening. I'm curious if you have any advice on that topic.
I've learned through that process, how shall I phrase it? I've learned through that process to be more open to other opinions. I don't like to be told what to do. Well, that obviously doesn't make me a great receiver of people's advice. But that was probably the biggest learning for me, is to be open to what others have seen on their projects, and then take it. And once you've done it once or twice or three times, you see that you actually benefit from it. It either saves you time, or you can build on something which has been done before, right? So your project is a follow-on project on someone else. So it really taught me the value of interacting. And I come back to that. It's all about the people. The better you can interact with your peers, with your subordinates, with your bosses, the easier it is to get something accomplished together.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's unfortunately or fortunately the way it is, right? Especially when you're in a higher leadership position. If things go wrong, it's on you. If things go well, it's on the team. That's another learning.
Every company is different again, and this thing called best practice sharing, of course, it's a best practice in itself, right? Of sharing these best practices. I'm curious if you've seen examples of, I like to call them rituals, like behavior patterns of significance, where companies have all kinds of different rituals in the way they do things, whether it's a meeting on a certain day of the week. Is there anything about best practice sharing where having a predictable cadence or a structure for sharing best practices makes it more natural and more open, as opposed to just...
There's a couple of ways. Yeah, there's an elegant way, like, you know, in your KPI Fire, you can flag the projects you're working on, and you can flag other project people you think, you know, they're interested parties in it. So they get in their report on KPI Fire, they can see what others are working on, right? And I'm a big believer of everybody should know everything, and then they can pull whatever information they need. So normally when I implement those tools, I make it open for everyone. I don't have the marketing group runs their own marketing projects and nobody else can see the marketing project. That's kind of stupid, right? But it does happen. And I'm not going to say it happens more often in Europe where people are more protective about the data than over here, but that might be true. It might not be. But that is one way you can use your software. You can use your electronic tools. Another one, of course, and you mentioned it already, is you have a meeting either weekly or monthly. That depends on your project kind of runtime. If you got lots of projects, they take months on end to complete. It doesn't make any sense to meet weekly, right? If you got lots of changes, then yeah, you might want to look at weekly, and you could have it at various levels. I always encourage the project managers to meet amongst themselves. Then you want to have like call them the black belt masters or master black belts to meet. So you create certain audiences, you know, for specifically that purpose of leverage, of sharing, right? And I'm always very interested in not just listening to the success stories. So when I look at project presentations, I always want to include the projects which failed. The projects which have been killed are sometimes the best projects because they save a lot of energy, they save a lot of frustration, and they actually make the positive projects happen. So we always try and encourage people on their presentation poster to include the projects they failed and why they failed. It sometimes is much better learning.
So they say that history can be some of the best lessons, and we learn more from our failures than our successes. I resonate a lot with that comment because there's also a lot of projects that get started and get some momentum, and then they run into some maybe just natural law, physical budget, some sort of a constraint where they just like have to stop. There's still a good idea. And then in some organizations, like maybe some time passes, if you lose that historical sense of what happened a year later, somebody's like, you know what we should do? We should do this. And everybody's like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go do it. And then you run into that same wall. So yeah, that's a great point.
You also got the other end of it, which I'm not going to say my fellow German citizens are famous for, but you also got those people who come and say, we've tried it already 10 years ago. It didn't work. Why should we do it now, right? So you got both ends of it. But yeah, you want to have a repository where you park those, right? I mean, there are no stupid ideas. It might be the wrong time. It might be the wrong angle you look at it, but it's worthwhile. What you want to make sure is that it doesn't become part of your, call it your active portfolio. I mean, we see that very often. I come into companies and they want to improve, let's say, their operations. They got 7 people working. And then I typically ask, okay, how many projects you guys are working on, right? And if you got 7 people work on 50 projects, there's something wrong, right? You cannot work on 7 projects effectively all the time. It just doesn't work. So that's typically one of the first activities we do, is go through those projects and weed out what they actually want to focus on. And we park the others in a completely separate spreadsheet, completely separate folder, something completely different, but that we don't lose that history of it. And again, I come back to, if the charter is well written, that's a place to document why your project didn't work. That's a place to document what you would do different next time. And if you have all those, that's one simple document. You don't need megabytes and megabytes of data. You just have it in one place.
That's a good example. Andreas, you're sharing some great wisdom on a bunch of topics here. I want to drill into one. How does somebody start working with Appirion? What is that? A phone call from a private equity firm who says, "Hey, we have this portfolio company. They're having some problems. Like, could you go talk to them?" What's a typical introduction to your company?
Yeah, we have, I'd say currently we have about a 50% billing from public companies. So we have a very high repeat rate. So companies we work with in the past, they come back to us. And the same kind of on private equity. So we're not really making a lot of promotion. You obviously find us on LinkedIn. You find a couple of our people on LinkedIn. We work mostly with senior industry people. So I'd almost pride ourselves that we're not really consultants, which sounds weird, right? Being a consultant, but we teach what has worked for us. So for example, implementing KPI Fire, I've done that. I know how to do this, and there might be 5 other ways to do it, but I know how it works, right? So that's what I do. The same on, for example, doing a pricing project. I've done that so many times. I know how to do it. I can tailor it towards the company. And that's kind of us. That defines us. We all come out of the industry. I'd say we're 80% heavy on the packaging industry. That's where a lot of us have worked in, which is a fascinating industry because we all are, at the end of the day, involved with packaging, right? The way we open our yogurt, the way we pull the tap on our milk or juice carton, whatever, we all in the packaging. And packaging is always, I say, it's the face of your product, right? It is the outside of what's inside. So that makes it somewhat fascinating and ripe with tons of opportunities. So people can find us very often. It's word of mouth that they say, hey, we heard you work with that and that company. We don't publicly promote kind of our customer names because sometimes the competitive space is fierce. And if a competitor knows we work with company A, oh, they're in trouble. So let's go after them, right? Let's eat their market share. So that's why we don't do that. That's why in our presentations, we rarely say where we've done something. We present case studies to say, hey, we've implemented a great continuous improvement project in the glass part of the packaging industry, or we've worked with a carton producer, or we worked with a flexible film converter. But we rarely give out names. But the people who start to know us, they come. I mean, you know, we're all easy to find. Our webpage, aperiacorporation.com, has a lot of the stuff we've done. And we look at, especially for the private equity industry, we're kind of, I would call, a full suite supplier. So we started a recruitment office a couple of years ago because we came across typical project would be a private equity firm wants to acquire someone, let's say in the packaging space. So they call us and say, can you guys help us with a pre-deal analysis? What do we want to watch out if we go in? What can we do with that company after we have it actually acquired? So we do that part. Then comes the post-deal, right, where we work with and we come in, hey, can you help us assess the management team? We want to do this and this, and we want to get in 3 years from A to B. What do you think needs to change? So we do that because we all have been there. I always say, especially with smaller companies, we've been where they want to go. I use that analogy from before. We can describe how the world looks like once they get to point B because we've been at point B, right? And we can tell them that, hey, you need 5 more market managers if you want to get to that level. You need to, whatever, hire 8 more salespeople, right? So that's kind of where we come into play with, as I always say, sharing what has worked for us. And there's many, many different ways, but we feel very, very strongly, if you've done something 3 times successfully, the likelihood that it works a 4th time is pretty high versus pulling a theoretical concept. And the other thing we do is we never leave with like just a presentation. We're not really big on theoretical concepts. We can do that as well, but there are other companies, say like a Bain or so, the larger ones, they have armies of analysts who work on the theoretical master concepts, but we're better at taking those concepts and then rolling them out. So like, if you will, like your KPI fire, right? It's for us. We probably could do something as well, but it's a nice tool. It's third party. So we're not shy on saying, hey, you know what? If you want to really do something which holistically grabs your entire company, look at this tool, right? So, and then we help them because we've done that before. We help them, as you know, we help them implement it. And that works well because we're not selling the software. We're helping them find a solution.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask you, like, this might be hypothetical, this might be practical. I want to talk about the continuous improvement system, like culture, the way that a company, and let's just say like it's a large manufacturing company with a couple dozen plants or sites, maybe it was put together through a merger and acquisition, and you're brought in as the CEO or consultant, and you get a design, like the structure of CI and the way people think about improvement, all the way from the shop floor worker, all the way up to the C-suite. Talk to me about like how you would like to see that structured as a program, even like the hierarchy, the reporting structures, that kind of thing. What would you like to see?
You first want to find out what is the current, I'd say, company culture. What drives the company? Is it more sales? So do they have like a CEO or leadership, which is after we want to grow desperately, kind of no matter what the margins or the costs are, but we want to grow for whatever the reason? Or are they more marketing oriented, right? There's companies where I worked before, like Henkel, the German multinational. They're very strong on brands and brand value and brand image. Or take Apple, for example, right? So if you want to drive continuous improvement, that is a mindset. It is obviously also a whole set of tools. It will become an organization, but you want to establish that mindset to say, in simple words, we want to be better tomorrow than we are today. And then the trick is defining that, what does it mean? What means better, right? And what means tomorrow? Is it a year from now? Is it 5 years from now? But that's where you start. And you typically start with the leadership of the organization to bring them on board to start it. I'd say it's a journey, right? Because it doesn't stop with 10 projects. It doesn't stop with appointing 8 people and say, level 3 in the organization, we pick 8 people. You're going to do CI now and come back to us in a year and report on all the savings you've done. Also, a lot of people associate continuous improvement with cost savings. That's wrong, right? It can be a lot more. It can be an organizational continuous improvement that, you know, the people work more efficiently, that you get, if you will, from an employer perspective, that you get more out of the resources you have employed. It could be a transformation that you go from a lot of manual work into automation. So continuous improvement can mean a lot of things. And I think the first one is to establish the buy-in into that mindset, being better tomorrow than today. And then describe to them on a leadership level, what would that mean? Because it means you're not happy with it today, right? You're not happy with a good year of sales because, A, it could be coincidental because of market situation. You want to do the next. So that is, call it create the curiosity, call it, you know, whatever. But that's the first thing. Then I would say still at that level, you want to define realistic phases. What do you actually want to improve, right? First thing comes to mind with everybody's cost. Especially in the example you stated, it was a couple of manufacturing facilities. So you want to look at, okay, how much cost could we actually take out without having anything suffer? How much working capital can we take down? How much inventory can we save? Then you start looking at the other angle of it. Okay, once we've done all that, once that machinery is humming and singing, how can we turn that into more sales, right? How can we transform marketing? So that is different at every company, but that is essential that you define kind of your building blocks of what you want to do. And then you break it down to the rest of the organization. Then you would invite, let's say, all the managers of a larger company, or you would invite all the operation people. And then you would create your case for that being better tomorrow than today. And especially important, the why. I'm a big fan of that why. So people got to understand the why. You also want to have them ask, okay, why do we want to do that? Why do we want to embark on that? And there's a couple of reasons, right? One, you want to be able to pay tomorrow's salary. I've yet to meet someone who doesn't want to have more money, right? It hasn't happened.
Me either. How funny is that?
It's interesting, right? So that's obviously a good answer on the why to do that. But then, yeah, there's more to it. You want to have your company be more robust. We're currently going through a lot of change in the industry, right? The tariff situation, we have a client, their raw materials out of a sudden have tripled because everything came out of China. So that was a big continuous improvement 8 years ago to shift everything to China, and now it's biting them in the back, right? So there's lots of changes, and that's the only constant is really that continuous improvement is continuous. It doesn't stop, right? So you want to build a company who is flexible but successful, that you can pay all the salaries, that you can expand, that you can make investments. And then when it comes to the organization, that really depends on organization size. I've seen organizations where they've done continuous improvement. I almost call it under the radar. So they do Six Sigma without actually calling it Six Sigma. They do project charters without actually calling it, because a lot of people, when you come in and you say, oh, we're going to roll out lean, they associate, we cut our workforce in half, right? That's not the idea of lean. That's not the idea of Six Sigma. That's why sometimes in some organizations, they do it under the radar. Others, you know, they're very bold. They say, okay, we put continuous improvement on our agenda. We're going to stand by it. We're going to anchor it in our strategy. We're going to anchor it in our vision, right? that famous, we want to be better tomorrow than today, I've seen now in a lot of vision statements, right? And that drives then the organization. So you would appoint a CI leader that could be preferably level one in the organization, but, you know, at least level two. And then you want to look at your resource base. If you have a company where they're not really known to work on projects, which is fundamentally different than do your day-to-day. A lot of people work on projects and they don't even know it, right? They perform tasks which belong to a project, and for them it's day-to-day. So those are the things you want to analyze and then see, is it opportune to have full-time people to work on projects? Or are you better off having 10 people spending 10% of their time doing a task versus one person doing that 100%? You know, what's the rationale? What do we gain? What do we lose? And that is kind of how you build the organization, because simply pulling people out of the organization, say, you're going to do this now, tomorrow, that's not going to work. So once you got your organizational frame, the next thing is then looking at what tools do we need to help to get from A to A1 to A2 before we actually arrive at B, right? So that breaks it into bite-sized pieces. And it is a journey. It is a journey. A lot of companies expect continuous improvement to be done in 2 years. We do continuous improvement. Yeah, great.
It will be done.
So it doesn't work that way. So that's, I said at the beginning, you know, we sometimes turn down projects. If that's the attitude and you can't convince that client, then we better don't get started, because it will be frustrating for everybody, right? We'll come out of it with a black eye and they will say, oh, look at those guys. They didn't know what they're doing. And we, of course, are not here to badmouth customers, so we keep our mouth shut. But, you know, those are the ones when we have our internal meetings where we say, geez, remember those guys, right? So we rather don't go there, right? So people need to be ready.
I think that's a key point. And that's part of why this podcast exists, is because I do think that in some organizations, continuous improvement or lean or has this kind of mental picture that, oh, that's this cost savings thing that we have to do for a little while, because I don't know, maybe our company was just acquired by, when they looked at our plant versus the other plant, we have this line item that's like 6% higher than everybody else in their portfolio. So they came in here and said, you need to save $2 million in this thing, go figure it out. Okay, we got there and we're done. I think that, you know, there's a famous Jeff Bezos quote that talks about the, you know, building a strategy based on the things that don't change versus the things that do change. And his point was, Amazon's focused on faster delivery and lowest price. Like, you know, it's not about any particular products. It wasn't about books. And that's one thing that I would say for anybody who feels like continuous improvement is a core value for them. It's also should be a core value for your company, because whatever is static and stable right now, it's only a matter of time before that's going to change. And, you know, you have to have this culture of improvement. And I hear you saying that same thing.
Is there, you find that everywhere, right? So we step into companies, for example, they have a high sales growth agenda. And they say, we don't have time for continuous improvement. And I say, you are doing continuous improvement already. And they're like, what? I said, yeah, if you want to have more sales tomorrow than today, you're already doing continuous improvement. You just don't know it. Because in order to have more sales tomorrow, you got to do something different than you do today. So we can help you with that to make it sustainable. So that's another angle to look at it.
You know, I touch on an interesting subject right there. I think you're exactly right. There's a certain element of this discipline of continuous improvement that really is just an evolution of scientific thinking, right? It's just, you know, we're all learning better ways to just do things. You know, now the popular thing that I hear is people talk about first principles. And I'm like, what does first principles mean? Well, root cause thinking or something, you know, it's like a five whys. I'm like, okay, yeah, that stuff makes sense. There's this truth that exists across these different methodologies. I think when you have a group of people that maybe choose to learn Six Sigma or DMAIC or Greenbelt, the benefit of doing that is that you get a vocabulary and like a common understanding, a way to speak about things, a way to refer to things that can pretty easily transfer. You can have somebody who is trained in a certain discipline come into your company. If they learned the same vocabulary, you can more quickly communicate with them. If you're using your own words and your own language for stuff. I mean, that's fine. It's nice to have your own culture to do those things, but using some common language that people understand, there can be some advantages to that too. Let me ask you a question about what improvement looks like. Let's say I'm a brand. I'm an owner, P&L responsibility for a brand across multiple regions, that level of a company versus, let's say I'm a plant manager versus I'm a person, you know, working one of the machines. How much of my time might be spent thinking about improvements at those three levels, for example?
I come back to what I said earlier. That really depends on your own curiosity. So you can be the guy at a machine going in, day out, clocking your 7 to 2 or whatever it is, your 8 to 4 with your lunch break and your coffee break, and you're happy doing this for kind of the rest of your life, right? Then you find those operators, same education, same everything, and they wonder like, Jesus, why do I always put 10 cucumbers in that glass and fill it with water? Why don't I try to put 11 cucumbers in there? That's a very simple example, right? Or why does my machine run, my printer, why does it run at 600 versus at 800? So what would happen? And then they start maybe playing around with it without actually more the trial and error thing, which also leads to great improvements oftentimes. So that's, again, one example at that level. The plant manager, again, same story. That person might be, I don't know, let's say mid-career end, happy that he got that job, a little stressed out because a lot of things can go wrong in a plant, right? So starting with that, you shouldn't live more than like 10 miles away, that if something happens, that you're there quickly and typically before the fire brigade or before the police or whatever else. So there's a lot of stress around being a plant manager. And a lot of times they don't have the capacity to really look at, you know, how can they do something better? And then you got the plant managers. They wonder, how can I make my life easier? That sometimes is a big motivator to drive continuous improvement. They think, Jesus, I got those forklift drivers. First of all, they crash every 4th day. And if I really map out a spaghetti diagram on how they run through my warehouse, no wonder they collapse because we got our raw materials at the completely wrong end of the warehouse. So I apply the lean push-pull here to establish where that stuff actually needs to be, or 5S or 6S, if you will, right? So again, for me, it comes back to the curiosity. And as a leader, I'd always think it's part of your job to instill curiosity into people. And I come back to that, you know, be better tomorrow than today. That kind of carries a lot. But that also is a driver for curiosity, that you make people curious. And oftentimes when I walk around, I'm like, okay, why are you doing this? Describe to me, what's your job? Your job is putting cucumbers in a glass. What is your real job? And through those questionings, I like leaders who question a lot because that shows to the other person that you have an interest. If you ask a question, you're interested in an answer typically, right? Unless how are you doing today? But if in the business world, if you ask a question, you're typically interested in the answer. So that's kind of how I would phrase it. You want to instill curiosity. And then the other thing I always like to see in leaders is that one question you ask is how can I help? Right? That makes people open up and they tell you how you can help. And if you take that honestly and seriously, that's a great foundation for driving improvements.
That's a great question. I was just going to ask you if there's one question that leaders aren't asking but should be. Maybe it's that one. Maybe you have another one in mind.
It is. I've seen that. That's why I said it. It's how can I help?
That's very good. Sometimes the goals that we set as individuals come from an experience, a question, something else that we saw done. You know, all of us, we probably all as human beings don't push ourselves as hard as like a coach, a mentor, a really great leader could push us. Is there some advice that you could give a leader, let's say a CEO to their executive team, or an executive team to a group of managers, or managers to a group of individuals that could help them push those folks to find those improvements that they themselves are capable and that their units are capable of?
Yeah, it sounds easy, and it obviously is not, because otherwise everybody would do it, right? Everybody could do easy. But you wanna as a leader, you wanna instill that culture that also people want this. And we all have experience in our careers, a cascading of goals, right? So the CEO looks out of the window and says, I want to have my inventory go down by 10%. No calculation behind, just looking out of the window, right? Some people would call that visionary, others would call it stupid, right? But anyway, let's say that becomes a goal, right? A target that will cascade down to the various levels, down to that guy on the shop floor, to the plant manager, and then they're all working towards it, only to find out later on that getting to 10% lower is almost impossible, and that whole company is kind of frustrated, starting with the CEO. So I would say it is, like what I said, one of my learnings, be open for other opinions. So you want to really interact. You don't want to work in isolation as a CEO. And you mentioned it could be a mentor, it could be a coach. And I draw a lot of analogies from sport. As you know, I've been very active and still very active on the sport side. And it is a very competitive world, but so is actually the business world. And you can draw a lot of analogy. I always say, for example, one of my sports, swimming. The person who goes 5 times a week, by definition, is better than the person who goes one time a week. So the same here. If you practice your curiosity, if you practice questioning, if you practice instilling that, okay, what do you guys actually want? Why are you here? Why do you come to work, right? If you're open to get into that dialogue, then you create a culture where that whole organization is ready to work towards that being better tomorrow. And sometimes it is, and I don't want to harp and promote too much kind of what we're doing, but sometimes it's you involve a consultant, right? So we sometimes come in to be the bad boys, right? That the CEO says, hey, I want this done. Can you guys bring that message across, right? Yeah, we get paid to do that too. But yeah, it is, you either bring in a consultant or you join industry forums. I always like the cross-industry forums and associations where you go maybe once a year and you talk to CEOs from completely different industries and you listen. I know a lot of CEOs, they take a lot of value out of those university, not executive MBAs, but those executive courses being offered the last 2-3 days, so don't eat it too much time.
Yeah.
It is kind of that open your mind, open. And a lot of CEOs I know and see, they lost the kind of time, they lost that spark to talk to their own people, really. That's what I would always encourage is go to the shop floor, be outside your predictable norm, right? If it's predictable, the CEO walks around every Friday morning at 8 o'clock at the shop floor. Everybody knows it and everybody prepares and all of it, right? And over time, CEO will only get to hear what he wants to hear because he made maybe clear through his actions and through his behavior, he's not interested in anything else. He doesn't even have time to really talk for 10 minutes to one person because he has only an hour in his calendar to walk that shop floor, right? So I would encourage people to step out of that, right?
Good to have those pattern interrupts sometimes. Uh-huh. There's two thoughts that come to mind on that topic. One of them is, one of the biggest forms of waste, referring to like the 8 wastes of lean, is underutilized talent inside of our own organization. I think that's one of the biggest wastes. I mean, it seems like ever since COVID and people working remotely, that's probably just, there's even ever more of that sort of waste. The other thing is that regardless of how big and powerful and knowledgeable and smart people you have in your company, whether you're Apple or Google or you know, just the biggest of the biggest companies, there's still more smart people with good ideas outside of your company than there are inside. So those are two thoughts that always keep me a little bit humble with making sure that we're, you know, trying to find the best of what, you know, internally, as well as keeping our eyes open to see what sort of things are happening externally as well.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with it, especially with your first statement. But oftentimes people don't know, and that brings it back a little bit to project management. Project management and projects are a great way to test out people on what they can do without shifting their role, without taking a salesperson move into marketing, or without a salesperson become a sales manager. You put them on projects to work on stuff where they can also get more confidence themselves that they can tackle different.
Is there there's probably no right answer to this question. This might be a little unfair, but if somebody has a day job, whether, you know, it could be in any function in the company, and they have a little extra capacity, let's say from 0 to 100, how much of their time does somebody need to have before they could realistically take on one of these improvement projects? What's your rule of thumb?
I would say the first improvement should be to understand where and how you spend your time. That's one of the things we like to teach.
Love it.
And it's very simple. You list all your activities, right? If you got more than 50 activities or more than 30 activities you perform in your job, there's already something wrong. You got to talk to your boss, right? So that's your first improvement project without actually running an improvement project, is understand where and how you spend your time. What are activities you could delegate upwards, downwards, sideways? That's the most important one before you sit down and say, yeah, I have 10% available. I would challenge that immediately. I would say, why is it 10% and not 15 or 20 or 5? What makes you believe you have 10% available? Is it because you can go home Fridays 2 hours earlier, or, you know, you stop doing emails and you stop working, you know, 2 hours in a week earlier? Where does your 10% come from? So that's where I would start. Your 10% is kind of a good number, right? That could enable you to become a project member, to work on a project team, because 10% is already, yeah, that's 4 hours a month. It's half a day, right? So that's not bad. I mean, is it super effective? Probably not, right?
Even 10% might be enough to get involved in an improvement project. Yeah.
Yeah, 10%, you could sit, you could share your, call it your wisdom, in 8 half-hour meetings.
Yeah.
So that's already looks completely different, right? Why do you need to sit for 4 hours in a meeting if all your contribution is 15 minutes, or let's say 30 minutes, right, on that interesting part? Meetings we try and set up, they have various come and go of people, because I hate to waste people's time. I hate to waste my own time. So yeah, that same measure I take. So when you look at these 4 hours, that could be completely different, right? I mean, the 4 hours are completely wrong spend. If you actually have to do 8 hours of data analysis, you just can't do it in four. So that is not good. But if you think about it, it could be 8 meetings, half an hour each. It could be, you know, 16 meetings, 15 minutes each, where you just come in and you share your opinion or your wisdom. So, yeah, I'd almost say there's no excuse. And that comes back again to the drive, to the curiosity. If you want to be better, there's always a way.
Absolutely. Well, for anybody who's made it this far in our podcast, they must have some intrinsic motivation to try to make themselves better and get some insights on how to do that. So I'm sure we're already halfway there if they've made it this far. Let's do this. I like to wrap up with a little segment I call the quick fire. These are just some questions, and you can just give me a quick answer to, and we'll just run through them. So is there a leadership lesson that you wish you learned earlier in your career?
I would say it's all about the people.
About the people. That's a great one. The most important job of a leader is blank.
Instill curiosity.
Is there a book or multiple books that you recommend?
Five Whys.
Five Whys. Wonderful.
There's one book I like, which accompanied me through my career, is called The First 90 Days.
First 90 Days.
You know, the U.S. presidents have 100 days. So that book is called The First 90 Days. Very interesting to read.
So in this toolbox of tools for Lean or Six Sigma, is there a favorite go-to tool that you turn to quite a bit?
Yeah, you probably would have guessed my answer. One is for sure DMake. The other one is, and we haven't talked really a lot about it, is the push-pull methodology. And then the third one, we haven't talked about it at all, which is very fascinating, is value stream mapping.
Finish this sentence. Continuous improvement is blank.
Being better tomorrow than today.
Love it. That's a great one. Okay, let me ask you about this, the push-pull. Uh-huh. Explain that concept for us.
So when you think about a manufacturing process, and let's say we take the packaging industry. I stay with produce because I know that very well, a juice or dairy carton. It starts with your raw paper, which comes in. You coat your paper. So that's one manufacturing step, the coating and the extrusion. You bring in other layers into this, either aluminum or plastic, or for sure plastic to avoid whatever product you store to come into contact with the carton. And carton, sometimes you bring in light stabilizers or UV protectant or whatever. So that's one step. The next step then is you're going to print the image of whatever that carton is, right? And then the next step is you either cut or form your carton, and then you ship it to the customer. So what's important on the push-pull is figure out which part of this sequence is actually driving your factory, right? So, for example, when your extruder works twice as fast, you increase the speed of your extruder, is that causing any problem downstream? Or if your printing setup, your printing press, you know, is at the bottleneck? So once you define your bottleneck, you can work on what is pushing right through the process. So if you start at the very beginning with that large extruder on these large paper rolls, if you increase speed on those, they certainly push everything else through the factory. But maybe that limiting block is, let's say, the forming end. So the forming end actually would need to pull, which means you cannot bring more through that forming end of your factory unless you increase the capacity on that forming side. So I don't know whether that makes sense, but that is kind of understand the flow. Now you can implement that in organizations. A classical one is I think, one of those Six Sigma studies or analysis, Six Sigma games, where you have to build something, I don't know what it is, a slingshot or something, and you got a design department, you got a marketing department, and all is obviously, you know, hypothetical, but then you find out the bottleneck might be in your accounting department. So that's the same story. So when you look at, for example, how long does it take in a company to satisfy an order confirmation, right? I know companies where it takes 3 days to confirm an order. I know companies where it takes 10 minutes, right? But when you go onto the Amazon, it takes 5 seconds. Yeah. So those are examples where you want to understand your push-pull to identify which block in that whole end is not working properly or is defining the speed of what you can do. I would encourage people who listen to this to reach out to us. We're always happy to just have a discussion. Not everything we do needs to end up in a project. And not every project we do has to end up to be, you know, multi-million dollars. And we're here, and true to my word, we're to help. It's very simple.
Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today, Andreas. We really appreciate your experience and your time and your wisdom here today. If anybody wants to follow up with you, how could they find you or where could they reach out to you at?
They can look up Andreas Mader on LinkedIn. My email address is amader@aperiacorp.com. Our website is aperiacorporation.com.
Okay, excellent. Wonderful. And for anybody, if you'd like to suggest a guest or ask a question or give us any ideas for future episodes, you can reach out to me, Keith Norris, on LinkedIn as well. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you have enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us on the socials and share the podcast with friends or colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.